Hello there. John Cassavetes' film Faces can be seen as an example of what was called American independent cinema of the late 1960s. And your reading for this week talks about that movement. I want to highlight some key elements here. First, I'll talk about what characteristics define Hollywood at its height, and then how this structure changed in the 1960s. When we hear the word Hollywood, we might conjure up a place outside downtown Los Angeles, or images of the beautiful people who live nearby, or think of the major studios who produce films there. The idea of Hollywood developed in the 1920s, partly as a marketing pitch for Southern California in general, and partly as a way to create a cohesive and glamorous identity for the various motion picture companies in that area. What we now call the Hollywood studio system dominated American film production in the 1930s and 1940s. In that era, major studios known as the Big Five, MGM, Warner Brothers, Paramount, 20th Century Fox, and RKO, controlled the production, distribution, and exhibition of most films in the United States. This level of control meant that the Hollywood studios in this era were vertically integrated. That is, they owned the backlots and studio spaces where films were shot, the cameras, lighting equipment, costumes, and props used in films, and they had actors and actresses, directors, writers, editors, and cinematographers under long-term contracts. These studios also owned many of the movie theaters where their films screened, and they had a network of sales agents who handled distribution to those theaters. If they didn't own a theater in a particular city or region, they traded off with other studios to get their films into those areas. You can probably already see that this system was very advantageous to the studios and not so advantageous to smaller theaters or independent producers who wanted to work outside the system. For much of the 30s and into the 40s, smaller theater owners challenged this system in court, and gradually the courts banned some of the practices the studios relied on. For example, in the 1930s, theaters could only buy films in large quantities, not individually, and often they had no idea what they'd be getting. They just heard titles or maybe that a particular star would be in one of the films. So if you owned a movie theater in the 1930s, MGM would come to you and say, "We're going to give you 5 comedies and 2 westerns and 3 dramas, and Jean Harlow will be in one of them." And that was all you knew. These practices were called block booking and blind bidding, and they were limited in a consent decree in 1940. What we consider the death blow to the Hollywood studio system came in 1948, when the U.S. Supreme Court, the cases had gotten that far, issued the Paramount Decree. The decision bore that name because Paramount was the main defendant, but the decree applied to every studio. The Supreme Court ruled that this system of vertical integration and long-term contracts and studios controlling local theaters was a restraint of trade and violated antitrust laws. Studios were forced to sell off their theaters, so they no longer had guaranteed places to screen their films. This decision triggered a chain reaction in which studios made fewer films, theaters changed owners and brought new partners into the field, and actors and directors began making package deals of their own, rather than being under the studio's control. And in the 1950s, movie theaters began competing with television for audiences' attention. During the studio era, a successful film appealed to a mass audience. Beginning in the 1950s and continuing into the 1960s, films aimed for niche audiences. We can think of teen films or exploitation films that dramatize current subjects such as juvenile delinquency, rock and roll, and beach parties. Theaters that were no longer under the control of the studios began to specialize, screening films by international directors from Italy, France, and Japan. These foreign films often experimented with camera work and editing structures and looser narratives that contrasted with tightly scripted Hollywood films. And they dealt with subjects that Hollywood had censored: adultery, drinking, divorce, all of which you'll see this week. This looser environment created spaces where a young generation of filmmakers could experiment with new subjects and techniques. In Medium Cool, the TV journalist had a poster of the French New Wave on his apartment wall. And in this week's film, you will hear a reference to Federico Fellini's La Dolce Vita, which highlights the influence of foreign films on 1960s American filmmakers. Your reading is absolutely right to note that one of the key changes in the 1960s was in the visual style of film, the way that shots and sequences were organized. We will see that in Faces this week. In Faces, you will see many tight close-ups, even tighter than in Wiseman's High School, and jump cuts that create a distracted, unstable sense of space and relationships. We don't have a secure foothold in the physical space the characters inhabit. Instead, we are forced to figure out who they are and how they relate to each other. Like Symbio, as Ricky called it, Cassavetes' films often feature a jazz score, as Godard did in Breathless. Cassavetes made an earlier film about a jazz musician in 1961 called Too Late Blues, and that reminds us how these independent films of the late 60s also reflected more offbeat tastes in music of the time. As your reading points out, different kinds of networks developed to support what came to be known as New American Cinema. Smaller, independent distribution companies handled films, and they often screened in art theaters in major cities, not the MGM Theater, but smaller, less fancy theaters in Greenwich Village or the Upper West Side of New York, for example. These new places to watch films reinforced their bohemian qualities. We talked about how major directors of the French New Wave, such as Godard and Truffaut, began as film critics. The young American directors of the 1960s didn't, but they were supported by a dedicated group of critics that included Pauline Kael, Renata Adler, and Jonas Mekas. Many of these writers lived in New York, which reinforced the image of the city as a hub for experimentation. Cassavetes and Bill Greaves, the director of Symbio, illustrate another trend in this period of actors turning to directing. That was not the norm during the heyday of the studio system. But in the late 1960s, you had actors train at the Actors Theater or in improv companies, become directors, and then use these improv techniques in their films. Faces received 3 Oscar nominations, for Maria Forrest and Seymour Cassell for supporting actress and actor, and for Cassavetes himself for original screenplay. The actors lost to Ruth Gordon for Rosemary's Baby and Jack Albertson for The Subject Was Roses. Mel Brooks won the Academy Award for Original Screenplay for The Producers, beating out not only Cassavetes, but Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke's original script for 2001. Faces remained one of the exemplary films of the New American Cinema of the late 1960s, and I look forward to watching it and talking about it with you. Thank you.